Around the time of Monty's sudden death, Agatha published a collection of short stories, The Mysterious Mr. Quinn. One of these, The Man from the Sea, contained a passage about a disreputable dog. The dog, who has spent his life roaming the streets of southern Spain, was standing in the middle of the road, yawning and stretching himself in the sun. Having prolonged his stretch to the utmost limits of ecstasy, he looked round for any other good things that life might have to offer. And then, without the least warning, a ramshackle car careered wildly round a corner, caught him full square, and passed on, unheeding. The dog rose to his feet, a vague, dumb reproach in his eyes, then fell over. What a long road Agatha had travelled, one on which she herself had been caught full square. From the charming young girl who lived at Ashfield and wrote poems like this one, Ma vie chérie, remembering her stay with her parents in France. Au pays de mon cœur, à toi seulement je pense. Au pot ma vie chérie, vers toi mon cœur s'élance. When she wrote this, Agatha was still in her idyll. Despite her father's death, life had scarcely touched her. With her long, slim body, her rivers of hair, which gleamed almost transparent in the sun, like the sea in the bay at Torquay, she belonged to the dream world of her own creation. A childhood friend wrote to her in 1966, I remember your lovely long fair hair. I was so amused by you remembering the dancing class. Now I recall it too, and a big mirror on the wall into which I gazed at my reflection on my sixth birthday. I remember you too, in a lovely accordion-pleated silk dress and longing rather hopelessly for such a dazzler too. You were like the sea nymph, Thetis, with your flowing golden hair. Agatha lived in a far more social life in the years after Frederick's death, although this made no difference to the fact that she was closer than ever to her mother. She went to dance classes where she was one of the elect in her pleats. She attended Miss Geyer's school 2 days a week. She made friends. James Watt's sister, Nan, whom she had met for the first time at Madge's wedding, remained close to her all her life and was briefly a crush of Monty's. Nearer to hand were the 5 Huxley sisters. Those Huxley sisters who strode along the Strand at Torquay with their arms swinging and heads thrown back with laughter, and cardinal sin against them they did not wear gloves, and the Lucys who lived on the beautiful sweep of Hesketh Crescent and had rather slurred, lazy voices that I found very attractive. Up and down the 7 hills the girls would walk in their corsets, one hand on their hats, the clean sea air dancing around them. They were carefree. The Lucys in particular worried about nothing in the world. What does it matter, Aggie? They ate whatever they wanted. Sumptuous teas, Devonshire cream, nougat bought at seaside stalls, and worked it off with walking, tennis, roller skating on the pier, swimming in the ladies' bathing cove. They went to Torquay Regatta, to the fair on the seafront with its coconut shy and firework display, to garden parties with their pistachio ices, muscat grapes, and warm swelling nectarines. It seemed that the sun shone all the time upon these healthy young animals, kicking up their heels like fillies in a field. We were conscious of all the happiness that awaited us. We had belief and joy in life. It was an enchanted atmosphere, protected by structures as unyielding as the bathing machine that took Agatha in her black alpaca swimsuit down to the sea, where she would swim out and be free. I remember you as Miss Miller, read a letter written to Agatha in 1970 by a man who had known her when he was a small boy. Miss Beeden of Copthorne I also remember, and I was thrilled one day to hear her say to you, come to tea, and my thinking how wonderful it was being able to invite anyone to tea like that without asking your mother's permission first. Agatha loved it all. She had a gift for pleasure. Anything she did, she enjoyed. And her mother encouraged it all. I wanted you to have a good time and pretty clothes and enjoy yourself in a young, natural way, she says, in Unfinished Portrait. Clara delighted in Agatha's attractiveness, which had burst easily from the child's solemn little chrysalis. Nevertheless, these were the thoughts that Agatha wrote for her mother, as Miriam, after Celia turns down a marriage proposal. And secretly, in spite of her disappointment and her fear for Celia's future, a little thread ran singing joyfully, "She will not leave me yet. She will not leave me yet. She will not leave me yet." After her husband's death, Clara had little independent life. As a widow, she found herself marginalized, although this was really more to do with lack of money. It made little difference to Agatha that she had to walk everywhere or paint her hats rather than buy new ones. That was how most of her friends lived anyway. None of the Torquay girls with whom she mixed was rich. They were merely comfortable, with all the attendant snobbery of the proudly non-vulgar. The Lucys are described in Agatha's autobiography as having a good laugh at the common legs of the local dancing teacher. But to a woman like Clara, money meant status. She was not importunate, as her mother had been, but neither did she have the powerful social assurance of Margaret Miller. Of course, poverty is a relative thing. Clara lived in a big house with servants. She was helped from time to time by her son-in-law. She was not in actual need. Nevertheless, she would seek to sell the Miller grave plot in the Greenwood Cemetery in New York, for which she had to pay just $30 or so a year, saying that the family was never likely to be in America and was in extremely low financial circumstances. Money was a continual worry to her, and the lack of it changed her life. She was unable to offer hospitality. The ingredients for a dinner party would have eaten deeply into her income, therefore could expect none in return. Her health had weakened to the point at which Torquay's unforgiving hills were beyond her, and she could not afford taxis. Although her mind bounced around as restlessly as ever, her world was inert. Agatha was at the center of it, and in Unfinished Portrait, the force of her mother's personality lures her daughter into a soft, mesmerized submission. The evenings were some of the happiest times mother and daughter spent together. They had supper early at 7, and afterward would go up to the schoolroom, and Celia would do fancy work, and her mother would read to her. Reading aloud would make Miriam sleepy. Her voice would go queer and blurry. Her head would tilt forward. Clara read Scott and Dickens to Agatha, missing out any bits she found boring. "All these descriptions," she said of Marmion. "One can have too many of them." She took her off suddenly to see one of Sir Henry Irving's last performances given in Exeter, in Beckett. For all her physical diminishment, she remained unchanged to Agatha. Impulsive, magical, cleaving like a knife to the heart of life. Celia thought about her mother. Her small, eager face, her tiny hands and feet, her small, delicate ears, her thin, high-bridged nose. Her mother. Oh, there was no one like her mother in the whole world. When Agatha was 15, Clara left Ashfield for the winter and took her daughter off to Paris. They stayed at the Hotel Diana, while Clara looked for a pensionnat at which Agatha might pursue her desultory education. To my mother, trying a school was exactly like trying a new restaurant. She was sent to Mademoiselle T's, where Madge had stayed before her, then to Miss Hogg's school at Auteuil, then to Miss Dryden's near the Arc de Triomphe. That was the kind of place girls like Agatha attended. If they failed to marry, it was the kind of place they ran. Agatha stayed in Paris for almost 2 years and was eventually very happy there, although when Clara had first returned to England she suffered terribly. As much for Clara as for herself, but then this amounted to the same thing. Sometimes it was as if she were the mother, Clara the child, whom she yearned to protect. If she put on a blouse her mother had made for her, the tears would come into her eyes as she thought of her mother stitching at it. Within her love, there was a painful sense of her mother's vulnerability, of the pathos in her indomitable vitality. So sensitive was Agatha's imagination that she was able to become Clara, or so she believed. Sitting alone at Ashfield, the spectacles slipping off her nose as she fell asleep over her copy of Nicholas Nickleby, the fire dying beside her in the schoolroom. Yet the natural joy in Agatha would always, in youth, leap into life. The dusk and honey colours of Paris began to charm her eyes. She had her first adult clothes, among them a pale grey crepe de chine semi-evening dress, which had to be filled out with flounces due to her lack of chest. She saw Sarah Bernhardt in Regin at the Comédie Française. She was taken to the opera by American friends of her grandfather, whose daughter was singing Marguerite in Faust. She took classes in painting, in dictée. Tu qui parlais si bien le français, vous avez fait 25 fautes. In dancing and deportment. Suppose now you were about to sit down by an elderly married lady. How would you sit? She ate cakes at Rumpelmeyer's. Those glorious cakes with cream and marron piping, of a sickliness which was incomparable. She fell for a hotel reception clerk, tall and thin, rather like a tapeworm, around whom she invented wild romantic fantasies. Later she met a young man, Rudy, half American and half French, with whom she skated at the Palais de Glace. From that moment forward, I stepped out of the territory of hero worship. I did not fall in love with Rudy. Perhaps I might have, if I had met him more often, but I did suddenly feel different. It was delight, all of it. The life that any normal, healthy, attractive young girl would long to live. But it left something out. At the end of this passage in her autobiography, Agatha wrote, almost matter-of-factly, "One dream of mine faded before I left Paris." She meant the dream of music. The truth was that during her time in France, it was the music that really filled her life. While the young Miss Miller was merrily engaged upon dress fittings and teenage crushes, her pure poetic soul was soaring inside her. Clearer and clearer, higher and higher, each wave rising above the last. This is how she described music in one of her earliest stories, The Call of Wings. It was a strange tune. Strictly speaking, it was not a tune at all, but a single phrase, not unlike the slow turn given out by the violins of Rienzi, repeated again and again, passing from key to key, from harmony to harmony, but always rising and attaining each time to a greater and more boundless freedom. Music for Agatha was the essence of the numinous. Its notes and sounds made the ineffable real, whole, graspable. For a brief time, she believed she could inhabit its world. She was like a young girl who dreams of dancing in Swan Lake, entering the land of aquamarine and gauze. For such girls, nothing thereafter is ever quite so strongly desired. At the age of 63, Agatha played the confessions game for the last time. In the drawing room at Greenway, with its beautiful Steinway in the corner, and in reply to the question, "If not yourself, who would you be?" she wrote, "An opera singer." Writing, for her, was the thing that she did because she had failed at music. She trained hard at the piano in Paris with a teacher named Charles Förster, practicing for anything up to 7 hours a day. But at an informal concert towards the end of her stay, nerves overwhelmed her, and she gave a catastrophic performance. To be an artist, one must be able to shut out the world. If you feel it there listening to you, then you must feel it as a stimulus, was how, in Unfinished Portrait, she recalled Förster's verdict upon her. But Mademoiselle Celia, she will give of her best to an audience of one or two people, and she will play best of all to herself with the door closed. She learned singing with the prestigious Monsieur Ball. She had a fine, clear soprano voice, which, mysteriously, flowered in public. When she sang, the outside world was a stimulus, and had been ever since she had triumphed as Colonel Fairfax in Yeoman of the Guard. "One of the highlights of my existence," which she had sung with the Huxley sisters at the parish rooms in Torquay. After 6 months with Boo, she was allowed to perform arias, Tegeli de Manina from La Bohème, and Tosca's exquisite Tisi d'Arte. When she returned to England, she continued to study and sang to acclaim at parties and local concerts. Then, after a visit with Madge in 1909 to see The Ring at Covent Garden, the dream of singing, of becoming Isolde, truly took flight. She could imagine nothing more magical than to pierce the heart of music, to sound the call of wings. I saw them, the wings, the colour of them, wing colour. Something in Agatha longed to step outside of herself and her imaginative world, to burst clear of its solitude and perform. Wagner she would love all her life. His music is at the heart of her very late novel Passenger to Frankfurt. But when, in 1909, an American family friend with connections at the Metropolitan Opera House agreed to listen to her singing, she was told, very kindly, that her voice was that of a concert singer only. Accomplished, charming, essentially weak. "So I put wishful thinking aside," she wrote in her autobiography. "I pointed out to Mother that she could now save the expense of music lessons. I could sing as much as I liked, but there was no point in going on studying singing. I had never really believed that my dream could come true, but it is a good thing to have had a dream and to have enjoyed it, so long as you do not clutch too hard." Sane, wise, realistic Agatha. Her idea of misery in the confessions entry that she made in 1903 was to wish for the unattainable. And this was what she truly believed. But this, from her Westmacott novel, Giant's Bread, is what she truly felt. The character speaking is Jane Harding, whose beautiful soprano is too weak for opera, but who sings it nonetheless. In doing so, she wrecks her voice forever. "I pretend I don't mind, but I do. I do. I loved singing. I loved it, loved it, loved it. That lovely Whitsuntide music of Solvay. I shall never sing it again." Jane fails at the thing she most wants to do, and in the face of this, she is magnificent. "It's been a gamble, you know, all along. My voice was never really strong enough. I gambled with it. So far I won. Now I've lost. Well, there it is. One must be a good gambler and not let the hands twitch." This kind of courage or personality was not Agatha's, although she admired it more than almost anything. Yet there is something of the secret Agatha in Jane. Jane as Solvay in Peer Gynt, with her silver thread singing steadily upward and ever upward, higher and higher, till the last note was left to her, high and incredibly pure. Then her voice was gone, my child, gone for good. Jane is supremely generous, unselfish and therefore unsuccessful, as both a woman and an artist. She gives up her voice for a man, Vernon Dare, who as a small boy played with poodle, squirrel, and tree, and who has grown up to be a musician. He wants Jane to sing in his first opera, and because she loves him, she agrees. Yet Vernon falls for Nell Vereker, a drifting fair-haired beauty with the looks of a nymph and the soul of a bourgeoisie. Nell had no talent, except for men, but even if she had, she would have risked nothing for it. She is Agatha's lesser self. Her greater self is Vernon, who, after a period of nervous breakdown, dedicates his life to art. As a child, Vernon had been frightened of the piano in his house, the beast, as he thought of it, with its terrible white teeth. But that was because he was resisting his calling. As a young man, he hears the words, "This night shall thy soul be required of thee," and knows that he must give his life to music. "I couldn't run away any longer. Music is the most wonderful thing in the world. There is so much to know, to learn. I don't want to play things, never that, but I want to know about every instrument there is. What can it do? What are its limitations? What are its possibilities? And the notes, too. There are notes they don't use. Notes that they ought to use. I know there are. Agatha began to write much more consistently in her late teens, although writing did not fill her mind as music had. It did not have the same capacity to stretch the world into its fourth dimension, which is what Vernon Dare seeks to do, and what interested Agatha so much in Giant's Bread. Music and infinity, music and mystery, music and art were as one to her. Music left nothing out. Of Vernon Dare she wrote, "He called it vision, for it seemed more that than sound. Seeing and hearing were one, curves and spirals of sounds ascending, descending, returning." He snatched at paper, jotted down brief scrawled hieroglyphics, a kind of frantic shorthand. There were years of work ahead of him, but he knew that he should never again recapture this first freshness and clearness of vision. It must be so. And so, a whole weight of metal, brass, all the brass in the world. And those new glass sounds, ringing clear. He was happy. And so the call of wings was about the transubstantial power of sound, and Agatha's first-length story, The House of Beauty, lived within the sphere of dreams, the places she had imagined as a child, and to which music had taken her. He was at the door of the house. The exquisite stillness was unbroken. He put the key in the lock and turned it. Just for a moment he waited, to realize to the full the perfect, the ineffable, the all-satisfying completeness of joy. Clara had encouraged Agatha to produce stories, as Madge had done, and from the age of 18 she banged them out on Madge's typewriter before signing them with various pseudonyms: Mac Miller, Nathaniel Miller, Sidney West. Unlike Madge, however, she failed to get anything published. This must have driven her to distraction. She knew she was as good as Madge. Her autobiography insists upon her lack of ambition at this time, and indeed, a good deal of her attention was taken up with dances and house parties. But the creativity and competitiveness within Agatha would not be stilled. Her life was enchantingly ordinary. Her imagination was fierce and unstoppable. "I pass, where'er I've a mind, with a laugh as I dance, and a leap so high. And nobody ever sees Harlequin, happy-go-lucky Harlequin, go by." Photographs from this time tell the tale of Agatha's social life. The regatta at Torquay, a party of theatricals at nearby Cockington Court, Agatha dressed as a gypsy, Sister Anne. A meet of the South Devon Foxhounds, a house party at Thorpe Arch Hall for the St. Ledger meeting at Doncaster. Another at Little Green House in Petersfield, for Goodwood. The captions are carefully inked next to the pictures, out of which Agatha smiles confidently. She was an extremely attractive girl. She was not brilliant, but she had an air of charming self-assurance, partly because, socially at least, she was out of Madge's shadow. Despite her Roman nose and heavy grey eyes, her face was very much her father's. She oozed a delicate, firm femininity. Men liked her, and she dealt with this easily, naturally. She took it for granted that she was pretty, and she was pretty tall, slender, and graceful, with very fair flaxen hair and Scandinavian fairness and delicacy of colouring. No doubt Clara told her how attractive she looked in her sweeping skirts with her quantities of pale hair, so long she could sit on it, piled on her head. But Agatha herself thought she was beautiful. "I was a lovely girl." She was Celia, going to a fancy dress ball as Marguerite from Faust. She was Nell Vereker, in the moonlight, with her princess's cascade of golden hair. She was a pierrette in high-necked blouses, a Thetis in patent leather-buttoned boots, an Isolde with tongued curls. Despite the complex apparatus of Edwardian dressing, her images of herself were always of someone loose and free and ethereal. Memories of how she had once looked would haunt her in later life. The golden green light, the softness in the air. With them came a quickened pulse, a stirring of the blood, a sudden impatience. A girl came through the trees towards him, a girl with pale, gleaming hair and a rose-flushed skin. He thought, how beautiful, how unutterably beautiful. So the nymph danced through the worlds of her protected youth, gazing towards a blissful future. What would happen to her? It was obvious. She would meet a man, her fate, and have a wonderful life with him, cooking or ordering the receipts that her mother had copied into an exercise book, giving birth to his child and wrapping it in her own christening lace, creating a world like Ashfield. Pierrot singing to the moon, for love of me, ages welling, find me dwelling, ne'er rebelling, by his fire. This was the only future that Agatha consciously contemplated. It was with this end in sight that she danced, dressed herself prettily, and sang after dinner, occasionally to a large teddy bear. All I can offer in excuse is that all the girls did that sort of thing. She was waiting to fulfill her female destiny, the one that women still dream of on the whole. "Wasn't sitting and writing," she said much later. "I was going about meeting young men and embroidering great bunches of clematis on cushions. We did lots of creative things in those days. Perhaps that's why we didn't feel the need for careers. When I was 16 or 17, only financial disability would have forced you out into the world. I think we had more fun then. Now, girls have to worry about A-levels. Flirtations to us meant a lot. You had lots succeeding each other. You went to all the dances, and on your card, you'd given 3 dances to one young man and only 2 to the other. It made you feel on top of the world. You were a young female, not bad-looking, and they had to please you. Columbine sits by my fire. She is mine, Columbine." People went to a lot of trouble arranging things. When he went to a house party, there were always 3 or 4 young men and nice-looking girls, so they could all have a good time. Even if you weren't allowed more than 3 dances with one young man, it was quite fun to get hold of him for that time. More than 3 dances with the same man was considered fast, but one managed. The innocence of this world was absolute, and the men preferred it that way. They treasured the purity of the girls they might marry. Just to be a woman made one precious. Men had affairs with married women, or with little friends in London. To Agatha, the idea that she would have sex with anyone but her future husband was as remote as catching the plague. She and her friends were protected, necessarily, she believed, against their own vulnerability. In the past, there were safeguards, as she wrote in her 1969 novel Halloween Party. People were looking after them, girls. Their mothers looked after them. Yet Agatha was not ignorant. She had heard all her life the whisperings of her grandmothers. A girl she knew had gone to stay with a school friend, and, too innocent to know quite what was happening, had been made pregnant by the friend's roué father. A male friend was shocked to be invited by a young girl, apparently of the marriageable variety, to spend an hour with him at a hotel before they went on to a dance. "I've often done it," she said. Agatha might not have been as shocked as the man had been. While she understood the importance of purity, she was no prude. She saw that purity derived its value from the concomitant value of sex. Later, she also saw that innocence need be nothing of the kind, and that conventional morality might have its own impurity. Jane Harding in Giant's Bread sleeps with Vernon. Nell marries him. There is no doubt whatever that Jane is the cleaner soul. But Jane is of the demi-monde. The world of Agatha's youth did not admit to her kind of transgression. Its sins took place behind curtains that were shaken every morning by servants, within structures as rigid as corsets, while smiles were fixed and tea was poured. Agatha was starting to realize all this as she wrote her first novel, Snow Upon the Desert, in around 1909. Its subject matter is the arrangement of love lives, sex lives. It is as far removed as possible from the stories and poems that had flowered from dreams. It was born of observation rather than fantasy, and it shows her, for the first time, getting to grips with the realities of being a writer. Poverty and ill health had led Clara to give her daughter her first season in Cairo rather than London. It was there that Agatha found the material for Snow Upon the Desert. The pretty but rather silent girl, "You had better try to teach her to talk," said a handsome captain to Clara, after a wordless turn with Agatha around the floor, was in fact noting everything, missing neither a trick nor a nuance of the sexual and social rond taking place around her. Slowly, remorselessly, she was developing her grasp of human movements and motives, seeing and delighting in their predictability. On holiday in Rhodes, watching the to and fro of hotel life, Agatha's detective Hercule Poirot comes to the same conclusion that she herself had done years earlier. Nature repeats herself more often than one would imagine. The sea, he added thoughtfully, has definitely more variety. Sarah turned her head sideways and asked, "You think that human beings tend to reproduce certain patterns? Stereotyped patterns?"
Precisément.
Agatha loved her 3 months at the Jazeera Palace Hotel. At this time, Cairo was a familiar and cheap destination for people of her class. She stuck into her albums many photographs from her stay, as usual carefully captioned. Polo, Cairo races, picnic in desert, Mrs. Appleton, Duke of Connaught, Lord Fielding. The exoticism of her surroundings, which would later set her imagination aflame, meant almost nothing to her. As far as she was concerned, Cairo was Torquay with pyramids, Kensington over sands. As one of the characters in Snow Upon the Desert, Lady Charminster puts it, Egypt, social Egypt, not the tourist's Egypt, all mummies and tombs and pyramids, but our Egypt. During the winter, there were 5 dances every week, and Agatha, coolly shimmering in a pale pink shot satin dress made by a Levantine seamstress, met around 30 men. Cairo as Cairo meant nothing to me. Girls between 18 and 21 seldom thought of anything but young men, and very right and proper, too. Considering how absorbed she professes to have been in enjoyment, it is remarkable how much she noticed. Agatha had been accustomed all her life to the conversation of women, the delicious phrases that could be picked out and stored. Like Miss Marple, who was very skillful in tones of voice, having done so much listening in her life. And indeed, like the musician she was, Agatha had an immaculately tuned ear. The opening lines of Snow Upon the Desert showed her ease in recreating what she had heard in Egypt. Rosamund, said Lady Charminster, is an amazing girl. Then, fearing that perhaps she had not done herself justice, she added with a flash of inspiration, she can neither be ignored nor explained. This was distinctly good. Lady Charminster felt that she had never done better. It was terse, it was apt, it was one of those concise sayings that have a certain backing of truth to their epigrammatic force. Of course, anywhere but in Cairo, Lady Charminster reflected, she would not have been sitting beside Connie Ansell. But Egypt, in its social sense, was distinctly limited. Snow Upon the Desert is a comedy of manners, worldly in the extreme, and although its structure is hopelessly disordered, 2 ideas stitch determinedly into 1 in terms of character portrayal. It is the finished article. This was what Agatha could do above all as a writer. Understand people. That was her true, her innate gift. As soon as she realized it, she was set free. The character of Rosamund Vane was her starting point, and she is almost worthy of a short story by Scott Fitzgerald. An aging beauty, unmarried, with a slightly used quality that can perplex, repel, and fascinate. Come what might, she would take her pleasure. Agatha had observed the original of this girl. Hardly a girl in my eyes, because she must have been close on 30. having supper at the Cairo dances, sitting between the same two men every night, keeping both in thrall. "She will have to make up her mind between them sometime," was the phrase that Agatha overheard. It was the kind of thing Margaret Miller might have said, and it set her off. On Rosamund, on her novel, and on ideas that she would use all her life. The way in which Rosamund plays her off two men recurs again and again in the detective novels. Here was one of the patterns that Agatha had begun to perceive, and in Rosamund there is something of, for instance, Alena Marshall in Evil Under the Sun, or Valentine Chantrey in Triangle at Rhodes. These women cannot exist without male admiration. For this reason, the world sees them as dangerous. Agatha's instinct told her that they were in fact vulnerable, prey rather than predators. In Rosamund, who at the end of the novel is doomed, a femme fatale about to be killed, lie the origins of the belief that underpins Agatha's detective fiction, that it is a victim's character that determines his or her fate. It was this that always interested her, the distilled essence of human nature contained within the act of murder. She was later contemptuous of Snow Upon the Desert, which was rejected for publication. "I made the heroine deaf," was what she always said about the book, as if that in some way invalidated the whole enterprise. Encouraged by Clara, to whom Agatha's novel was both an excitement and an inevitability, what couldn't her daughters do after all, she sent the manuscript to a neighbour in Torquay, the writer Eden Philpotts. He responded with perceptive kindness, "You have a great feeling for dialogue," and sent Agatha an introduction to his own literary agent, Hughes Massey. This firm would later have the immeasurable good fortune to represent her. But Massey himself, whom Agatha went to see in London, told her that Snow Upon the Desert was best forgotten. Better advice would have been to tell her to rewrite the book, as it is full of quality. Almost every character is given a phrase and insight that brings them to life. Agatha could see people almost as well as she could hear them, and above all, she could intuit. Bitchy little Hyacinth, for example, desperate for the attention of every man in Cairo, is clever, very clever, so clever that no man ever suspected the fact. Told by one of her targets, Tony, that his fiancée is coming out to Egypt, she cogitated deeply. "Will she interfere with me?" was perhaps the burden of her maidenly meditation. After a moment's consideration of this knotty question, she turned to Farquhar with her sweetest and gentlest smile. "Is not the sunset beautiful?" she murmured. And the semi-deaf heroine, Melancy, engaged to Tony and meeting him again for the first time in months. It was all so different from what she had planned, but much nicer. Oh yes, much nicer. She impressed this latter fact on her mind. It was much more natural, much simpler, and jollier. "This is just heavenly," sighed Tony, gazing rapturously at his fiancée, with his mouth full of whitebait. "I was so disappointed and lonely when you didn't come this morning," murmured Melancy. "Poor little girl," said Tony, touched and distinctly approving. "Very nice and right of Melancy," so ran his thoughts. Then Melancy falls in love with another man, and Agatha's book moves tentatively towards the territory she would later explore in her Mary Westmacott novels, that of the human mysteries that cannot be solved. The breathing, living personality of the man who had just left her replaced all else. Melancy looked around her. The beauty of the rose garden was as great as ever, but she saw it with different eyes. A world of warm, living realities had taken the place of dreams. From Melancy's heart went forth a warm, personal need of all this quivering, feeling world around her. In the distance, she heard voices. They came to her with the human call of comradeship. Her gladness was full and complete. This was not yet Agatha's own experience. She did not fall in love in Cairo, and would not do so for another 3 years. But she knew what it would feel like, so she wrote it anyway. She lifted a hanging rose and laid it against her cheek. It was not for its beauty, but because it was alive.